This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The National Collegiate Athletic Association's opened the door for student athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness. And a lot of the discussion is following around high-profile stars, but there is a small fraction of the student athletes out there that are affected by the NCAA rules. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton tells us about the proposed change by the Indianapolis-based NCAA that could go well beyond endorsement deals.
Right now, NCAA rules prevent student athletes from making money in all kinds of ways, including profiting off their own businesses, unless they receive a waiver. Former Texas A&M cross-country athlete Ryan Trahan learned that lesson the hard way. A couple years ago, his eligibility was revoked after he promoted his water bottle company on his YouTube channel that also highlighted his time as a Division I athlete.
Basically, I have to hide the fact that I own this company that I'm so proud of and have worked so hard on. And the other option is I can promote it all I want, but I can't let anyone know that I run cross country and track for Texas A&M.
That's Trahan in one of his online videos. At the time, he said he was left with a decision he felt was unfair.
When you have to follow rules that you don't agree with and rules that you think are ethically wrong, it's just so frustrating.
Those rules could be changing. The NCAA board recently recommended an overhaul that would roll back some of the restrictions on what student athletes can earn. The NCAA, headquartered in Indianapolis, didn't respond to a request for an interview. Morgan Chall is a former college gymnast and now chairs the NCAA Division I Student Athlete Advisory Committee. With this announcement, she says athletes may not have to make the choice Trahan had to.
And what this means is, in terms of entrepreneurship and professional development, if I wanted to publish my own book or start my own business, I would be able to do so. I just wouldn't be able to accept any compensation for it so long as I'm a student athlete.
And now with social media and technology, rules made decades ago need to be updated. She says the change will not affect just elite athletes receiving endorsements. It will allow all student athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness.
Which are the issues that 98% of student athletes really face with, honestly, not even 98%, I'd say 100% of student athletes face with the current rules.
Including student athletes at the University of Evansville in Southern Indiana. The volleyball team at the Division I school plays against conference opponent Bradley University on a recent evening. Athletic Director Mark Spencer stands to the side of the court watching the game. After years of conversation about the NCAA rules, he's waiting to see a final outline of the rule change, but generally supports the concept. He says he and other athletic directors and schools want to give students a chance to create and promote their own businesses, as long as there are boundaries.
We hate having to have student athletes be separated any more than they are from being a normal student. So if normal students can profit from it, then why not the student athletes?
It will be at least many months before the rules might change. But with a growing number of states considering legislation to force the issue, many say change is inevitable. Josh Boyd is a professor at Purdue University's Brian Lamb School of Communication and has written about the NCAA and the business of amateur athletics. Boyd says the rule change will transform college sports. But he says any implementation will be complicated, and he fears it could widen the separation between student athletes in higher and lower profile sports.
And I know that's one of the things that the NCAA has talked about, being a disadvantage of paying players or having any kind of compensation for athletes, is that it would widen that divide.
Morgan Chall with the Student Athlete Advisory Committee agrees and says without clear guidelines, allowing student athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness could do more harm than good.
No one's talking about how any of these proposals are going to impact limited resource institutions or historically black universities and colleges or international student athletes. And it could really limit the future opportunities for all of those groups of people.
Each of the three divisions under the NCAA will meet and establish rules within the guidelines the NCAA creates with a target start date in 2021. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
Two longtime Indiana environmental groups have merged, and they've drafted some plans for a refocused mission on children's environmental and health initiatives. We're talking about the merger of the Hoosier Environmental Council with Improving Kids' Environment. And to find out more, let's check with Jesse Carbonda, who is the executive director and now of the merged organizations, but he is definitely the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And with us, we have Dr. Indra Frank, who is the HEC's environmental health specialist. She is, of course, in her job working there as well as with HEC as the environmental health director. And both of you, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Glad to be with you, Chris.
Yeah, good to be here, Chris. Thanks.
Jesse, I'll let you start off and let us know a little bit about the history, I guess, of both organizations. We know pretty much about the Hoosier Environmental Council, but about improving kids' environment, tell us a little bit about the organization and the 20 years plus that it's been around and the interest in being able to be able to merge both organizations together.
Improving Kids' Environment was founded 20 years ago, and its aim was to figure out how to reduce risks, toxic risks to kids, whether it was in the context of homes, schools, or the community at large. And from my vantage point, one of the benefits of bringing these two organizations together is that it increases our legislative capacity to help improve children's health. Mm-hmm. In particular, one of the things that I've come to learn is that this merger will lead to about a 25% increase in our email contact base, and that allows us to have even greater capacity to try to galvanize the public to address a number of pieces of legislation that have bearing on children's health.
I would imagine that also gives you the opportunity with the base to be expanded to include not only health professionals, but educators and families as well, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. And those are constituencies that while we have relationships with over our 36-year history, this no doubt enhances it, given that Ike held conferences year after year, which brought in folks who were running schools, who were running daycare centers, public health professionals, and so forth. So those are constituencies that may or may not have been aware of legislation that has bearing on children's health, like funding for IDEM, like funding for the Indiana State Department of Health and county health departments, which certainly the more funding we have, that means we have more inspectors, that means we have the ability to retain quality permit riders, and ultimately those things benefit public health. So from my vantage point, and I know that Indra will speak to the very specific initiatives that we'll be taking on, proactive initiatives, but I really want to emphasize the importance of it expanding our legislative capacity.
Before we look at the initiatives here, Dr. Frank, tell us if you've had an opportunity with your tenure with the HEC as the Environmental Health Director, if you had some contact to improving children's environments, and what kind of work that you've been able to do either alongside them or with them, I guess, in many respects?
Well, good question, Chris. I'm a physician specialized in environmental health, and in the 15 years that I've been practicing environmental health, I've spent a good portion of that with Improving Kids' Environment. I served on their board of directors for a total of 9 years before I even became affiliated with the Hoosier Environmental Council. I've come to the conclusion that, you know, every environmental problem has human health consequences, and our children are often the most vulnerable when it comes to environmental problems impacting their health. Pound for pound, children breathe more air, drink more water, and eat more food than adults do. And so if there are harmful exposures in those media, they wind up with a disproportionate amount. And then they're also more susceptible because their bodies are still growing and developing, and those developing systems may not be mature enough to handle a harmful exposure.
Will you tell us about the different children's health initiatives that the Hoosier Environmental Council now with improving kids' environment in this merger will be able to accomplish, or maybe some new initiatives that you'd like to establish?
Oh, absolutely. So all of the work that Hoosier Environmental Council has been doing benefits the children of Indiana, but this gives us an opportunity to really intentionally focus on the things that are particularly harmful to children. We have three initiatives that we're launching with this merger. One is to provide an information resource on children's environmental health. Improving Kids' Environment built a very helpful website that serves families and educators and healthcare professionals on children's environmental health issues. we're going to maintain and build on that website so that there's a really good information hub. And then second, we're going to continue Ike's work to reduce lead poisonings in Indiana. More than 1,000 children each year have elevated blood lead levels in Indiana, and that could put both their intelligence and potentially behavior problems at risk. And then third, we're working to ensure that Indiana's children have clean water to drink and clean streams and lakes to play in. And there are multiple initiatives at Hoosier Environmental Council that are working both, you know, during the legislative session, but also with programming in the communities to reduce impacts to our waterways, especially of E. coli. So E. coli is a bacterium that comes from feces, and unfortunately, it is the top pollutant in Indiana's waterways. We have several different initiatives to help Indiana move forward with reducing that pollutant.
Jesse, how long has it gone on in this the talks that have led to the merger of improving kids' environment and the Hoosier Environmental Council together on these common goals? How long have you been talking and finally culminated in the merger?
Chris, discussions began in July 2018, and as any responsible organization would do, we wanted to think through this from the standpoint of finances, that this was a sound decision for HEC. We wanted to think about this in terms of strategy. Would we be able to absorb the, elements of the programming of Ike? Would we be able to enhance the relationships, or could it be potentially detrimental to bring these groups together?
Yeah.
So once that due diligence was done, we proceeded ahead.
What has happened now as far as improving kids' environment? Are they pretty much of the HEC within this coalition that's been created, or does some staffers come on board with the HEC on this particular project or separate from it now?
There will not be any staff or board that will be joining HEC. However, I think that the great benefit that I see is that, number one, that as Indra mentioned, there will be a web portal that we'll be inheriting, which is very well regarded in the public health and educator community, given all the work that Ike did to help to mitigate risks from things like pesticides and lead. And so that's a portal that we will continue building upon. And that will be a very important resource going forward for those educators and health professionals. And then the second thing is, once again, just the breadth of context that we'll be able to bring on board and engage, particularly from a public policy perspective. Because I think a lot of these folks, educators and health professionals, will probably be getting engaged principally from a programming lens. And I think now my hope is that we can engage them on a legislative lens.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 2020 session, I can think of at least three different pieces of legislation that we anticipate that have real bearing on children's health, including mass transit funding legislation, which, of course, would help to reduce toxic risks from auto exhaust. I can think of this ongoing effort to try to pass legislation related to confined animal feeding operations, which would certainly reduce risk to both air and water in rural areas, and then a third would be related to septic tanks and ways of stepping up inspection of those septic tanks so that they don't pose risks to private drinking water wells.
Jesse and Dr. Frank, are you both feeling that with this merger of the Hoosier Environmental Council and improving kids' environment, that that you have an exciting future? Obviously, you've talked about some of the initiatives that you'd like to see introduced in the General Assembly in the session coming up in about 3 months from now. But do you think that it's going to be an even brighter future for both organizations melted together and working toward this common goal?
I know Indra will have more to say here. But Chris, absolutely. I mean, I think that the scale of the threats facing the environment are significant, and collaboration is such an important theme of Hoosier Environmental Council. It's reflected in Green the State House, which is going to be coming up on November the 16th, where we'll be bringing a few dozen different organizations together. And I think the ultimate in collaboration is of course, a merger. You may recall, Chris, that we had our first merger in 2011 when Legal Environmental Aid Foundation merged into HEC, and that has worked wonderfully.
Mm-hmm.
That led to an enhanced presence of HEC in Northwest Indiana. It also led to us having an in-house legal program. And I think that, as Indra mentioned, bringing on board Ike into HEC will enhance our visibility among those for whom children's health is first and foremost in their mind.
This is a very exciting opportunity. For me, personally, it means an opportunity to return to working on children's environmental health issues like I did when I was serving on the Improving Kids Environment Board.
It's going to be a very, very busy early 2020, won't it?
There's always plenty to do.
It certainly sounds that way. I mean, we have two organizations together, well-established over the decades, and the same basic goals of improving the environment, primarily for one, with children in mind, and everybody in general, including children, for the other. Certainly that this next year is going to be a very, very busy one for the expanded Hoosier Environmental Council, including the Improving Kids Environment. Jesse Carbonda is the executive director of the HEC, and Dr. Indra Frank is the environmental health director for the HEC. And thank you both for joining us today and telling us about this interesting merger of these two longtime environmental groups in Indiana and the refocused mission that you all have for youngsters and their health and their welfare. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Pleasure talking with you.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for the introduction. Today, our guest is Mr. Ty Warner. He's the Executive Director of the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, or NERPCE. Ty, welcome back to the show.
Carl, great to be here. Thank you very much.
So, again, frequent listeners hear a lot about NERPCE, but remind our listeners briefly what NERPCE is and what NERPCE does.
Yeah, NERPCE is the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, and it is the Regional Planning Commission for Northwest Indiana, which is a regional council of governments. So all the municipalities in a three-county area and the counties themselves send representatives to NERPCE as the governing board. And so we talk about stuff that is bigger than any one municipality or community, stuff that affects everybody region-wide. And we also have a really important function that's federally designated, which is as the Metropolitan Planning Organization for Northwest Indiana, which means that federal transportation funds essentially flow through NERPCE to be able to reach communities and help them do good projects.
Well, Happy New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year, you too.
You know, I know you had a busy 2019 at NERPCE. So what are some of the highlights?
Yeah, we did have a very busy 2019. A lot of exciting things happened last year. I think probably first and foremost, we adopted a new regional plan. Mm-hmm. We have as a requirement in federal law to adopt a regional transportation plan, but we've taken that a step further to be much more integrated, much more comprehensive. Our last one was the 2040 comprehensive regional plan that folks are familiar with because we've talked about it a lot. And now that's been superseded by NWI 2050, which respects all the foundation of the 2040 plan but takes it into the next level. And part of that is much tighter integration with our transportation improvement program, mm-hmm. which is our four-year short-range transportation project program of what's actually getting scheduled to be built, to be constructed in Northwest Indiana in terms of transportation. And those things are tightly connected so that the goals of the region are carried out through on the local level through the local projects that are done, all leading up to a good whole for that overall regional vision, which is to create a region that is connected, renewed, united, and vibrant.
Sure. You know, as we talk a little bit about that plan, you know, we're seeing truck traffic and things increase, but we're also seeing a lot of people from the past holiday season. You know, sales were up, yeah. You know, the Amazons of the world. How's that affecting and how are we planning for the future of these short deliveries coming from, you know, like the Gary, Indiana Amazon facility?
Right.
How do we plan for that?
Well, it's really interesting. We've just done a household travel survey mm-hmm. that was last done in 2008, and then we did it again in 2018. So as we've gotten the data back from that and are, you know, parsing through all of that, one of the first things to jump out on us is the reduction in retail trips.
Sure.
And this is really no surprise with the growth of online retailing and e-commerce, down almost 10%.
Wow.
From 2008. It was about 20% of all regional shopping trips, of all trips were shopping retail related in 20% in 2008, and now it's down to about 9%.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So, you know, as we talk about, you know, planning, I know there's a lot of different projects that are moving forward. So any updates on railroads and some of the things that are going on with our local railroads? Again, you know, we hear so much about railroads and, you know, the different things, how it impacts our economic development here in Northwest Indiana.
Right. Well, a few things have happened last year. We convened a rail crossing task force that was spearheaded by Mayor McDermott from Hammond, talking about rail crossing blockages and what a safety issue this has been. And so we have explored all facets of that issue to try to keep crossings free. And a really challenging issue, but we've been trying to address that to keep things flowing across, because obviously it's an environmental impact to have idling there at tracks. And as you can't cross those locations. And then the state of Indiana also did a local tracks program, which they designated funds to help separate crossings and to be able to make those safer. There's a lot of need in Northwest Indiana. We are the crossroads of America.
We are.
And that applies to rail as well. So it's a real challenge to try to it's very expensive to separate roads from rail, but we're thankful for the help that the state was able to give last year.
You know, as we talk a lot about, we talked about rail. Let's talk a little bit about water and some of the things that are going on with our collaboration with the Port of Indiana. Again, I think we've heard things with the new casino, the development of Buffington Harbor, or the Port of Gary, and how that's going to affect, and some of the things that potentially we might be planning in the future for that area or for port development.
Yeah, it's all integrated with the whole Northwest Indiana landscape. We've done some watershed studies, Deep River and elsewhere, to try to look at where the flow of water goes through Northwest Indiana and how it affects for potential water quality, flooding issues, et cetera. But that's all tied into the commerce of the port, future harbor development. People don't often realize that we've got a coastline in Indiana.
Absolutely.
And
no,
if you're
so
not
true.
Necessarily from this region, it sometimes comes as a shock to folks that Indiana has a coast, and we certainly do.
So as we integrate other technologies into NERPC's 2050 plan, just talk a little bit about some of those things. I know that every day we hear something about electric vehicles, electric charging stations, the future of mobility. A lot of other communities, areas throughout our state are with motor scooters and, electric this, electric that, bikes, integrating that into our daily living.
Absolutely. Yeah, that NWI 2050 plan that I talked about examined all those things that you mentioned, and to try to gear us up for a future that may include that and looks very much on target to do much more electric vehicles and autonomous vehicles and all of that way off into the future. So, and as I think we've talked about before on this show, huge impacts on land use and travel. A lot of different theories about what impact that will have, but we're trying to prepare for either of those scenarios.
I know Kathy Luther has been on the show just recently in 2019. She talked a lot about brownfield redevelopment in our area. Can you address a little bit about that?
Yeah, we received in 2019 a $600,000 brownfield grant from the Environmental Protection Agency, which is fantastic. That's with the partnership of with the Regional Development Authority and the Northwest Indiana Forum, which just speaks again to the testament of all these groups coming together to try to address regional issues. Just like I talked about with the challenges with rail and how expensive that is, brownfield cleanup is very expensive, but we're very thankful for that support to be able to make a dent in that issue too. If we can turn these projects around, clean them up, that means more economic development opportunities for folks and, of course, more of a, as you like to say, more of an environmental legacy to leave for this region.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for being on today, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Ty Warner, Executive Director of Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, or NERPC. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us, and remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Support for Green Fleet Radio comes from South Shore Clean Cities and NERPC. You can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcasts, by the way, are always online at lakeshorepublicradio.org. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Stephen Malusnich is a current freshman at Valparaiso University. He's also a first-year member of the VU Jazz Ensemble. And he and a lot of other people in the VU campus are very concerned about the state of affairs, so to speak, that in turn may affect the university's jazz program and the people who are on the faculty, in particular, Professor Jeff Brown. Stephen Malusnich is with us to talk more about it and the latest on the petition drive that is out there. Stephen, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'll let you go through the background here. Tell us more about your interest and your concern about the Valparaiso University Jazz Program and the ensemble and all the other programs and the faculty members that are involved in this and why you started the petition drive.
This past November, we were informed by our director, Professor Jeff Brown, that as of May 2020, that his position will no longer be at the university. And he is the driving force behind the jazz program, and he's the one who has started and really taken to the level that they are now, Jazz Fest, and also our monthly performances at Duffy's Bar and Grill in Valpo. And my concern is if Professor Brown's position is eliminated, then there's really no one else who is as capable as he is that would be next in line, so to speak, for that position. And so in November, I started a petition on paper, and I received about 300-400 signatures. And frankly, it was a very busy time of year. We had Thanksgiving break and then Christmas and New Year's. And so when I returned from our Christmas break, I decided to launch an online version of the petition on change.org. And this is the eighth or ninth day that it's been online, and we have close to 2,000 signatures on the online petition alone. And our main goal is basically to preserve Professor Brown in his position as director of the jazz ensemble, thereby ensuring the commensurate continuation of the program at Valpo.
This past semester, when you learned all about this, what did they tell you as to the reason why Valparaiso University was making the decision to cancel the jazz program and in turn Professor Brown's position?
There have been a lot of recent budget cuts made at the university. The men's tennis and men's soccer teams have also suffered as a result.
Do you think that maybe this here it is just a continuation of having to take a look at the budget, make some decisions on a top level as far as, in this case, the jazz program is concerned?
I believe so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What impressed you, just being a freshman, you get to come in with fresh eyes, so to speak, and no preconceived notions about the Valparaiso University Jazz Program. Number one, what interested you first off in going to Valparaiso University and get involved in the program? And what in turn has impressed you to the point that you wanted to go out there and quite literally probably stick your neck out as a supporter of the program?
I'm from Valpo, and I went to Valparaiso High School, and I was in jazz at the high school for about 4 years there, and we were one of the Valpo's one of the bands that participates in the Jazz Fest every year, so I did have some exposure to the jazz program in that regard. And when I enrolled here at Valparaiso University, one of the first things I wanted to do was enroll in the jazz program, because it seemed like it was a very strong program, and that the kids in it had a lot of fun. And in just my short time here, I have really noticed, I've taken note the level of commitment that Professor Brown has to his students and to his job. He puts in much more time and effort than is necessary, and I think that's the main reason why the VU Jazz Ensemble is as well acclaimed as it is.
Have you had a chance to get, obviously you had last fall before the holiday break came up here and the end of the fall semester going into the spring semester there at VU. What kind of help have you gotten from your fellow students to continue on, as well as what you've done in the change.org website?
There are some bandmates that I have who have been helping me distribute the petition. So far, I've been the main organizing. I've been trying to find more students to help get the word out, but I've just been doing in my free time, which makes it a lot easier to distribute now because it is now online. Mm-hmm. There was an article that came out in the VU paper on Friday, and since then I have gotten a lot of people who have been reaching out to help you as one of them, and then I've also had an interview with the Post Tribune and the Times. Mm-hmm.
And what kind of reaction have you gotten from the folks on the faculty, as other faculty members, and in particular the administration?
There hasn't been a lot of communication from the administration. My current plan is to, my goal is 10,000 signatures on the change.org website. And once I have that number, I'm going to attach the letter that I prepared to the administration with the signatures and submit them. But so far, the overall response has been fairly positive. Change.org is that you can leave reasons for why you signed, and I haven't read all of them yet, but there are hundreds and hundreds of comments that mention what an impact that Professor Brown has had in their not only collegiate life, but also professionally thereafter.
Well, it sounds like, obviously, if you're looking to a goal of May of this year, when they're supposed to make the official decision about the Jazz program and about Professor Brown's position, you've got a few months left, but you don't have a lot of time left. So you're hoping that more of the signatures come in, so you have that 10,000 that you're hit for the goal, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. If there's anything that you haven't already mentioned to us today here on the program, or anything in particular you would like to say to get the word out as well about the your feelings, the importance of having a Jazz program of the caliber and the popularity is at Valparaiso University, what might that be?
Petition is online. It's on change.org, as I've mentioned. The petition is called Save VU Jazz. If you search on change.org, it comes right up. Mm-hmm. And there has been recently, as a matter of fact, the director of the music program an entire music program, Dr. Moggins, has said that jazz will continue. However, I feel that if it continues without Professor Brown, that it won't be to the caliber that it has been during his tenure there because of his expertise and his commitment to the program. Yesterday, actually, I was thinking about it, and I figured out a way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
I am trying to save the university jazz program, but more so I'm trying to save Professor Brown's program because he has been a driving force in the program's continued success.
Okay. Now, I have to ask you, have you gotten any word back from Professor Brown? He's a pretty modest fellow, so I'm not sure he would say a lot, but I'm sure he probably has some feelings, certainly, besides personal feelings, about what the petition drive is all about.
Professionally, he is not really able to speak in support of or to condone the petition. But he has asked to remain separate from that, and so because that would be a conflict of interest, and so this has I haven't talked with him a whole lot about that.
Well, Stephen, thank you for spending time with us to talk about the petition drive that you have out there on change.org to save VU Jazz. And I'm glad to hear that you have as many supporters and names and already listed on the petition. And we hope that you'll get back in touch with us, let us know how the petition drive is coming along. And the better that we have some good news to report that Valparaiso University is able to find a way to keep the jazz program, including the jazz festival that's always underway, and with Professor Jeff Brown's position. Thanks very much for spending time to talk with us today.
Thank you very much for the exposure.
You're welcome. Stephen Mnuchin is a freshman. He's also a first-year member of the jazz ensemble at Valparaiso University. And he, as we've mentioned, is the creator of the petition that's out there on change.org for everybody who supports the VU jazz program to help keep the program going in the years ahead. There's a measure that is now in the General Assembly that would deal with some of the issues here in Northwest Indiana involving Lake Michigan access. And we have an organization that is helping the Save the Dunes organization in Northwest Indiana with this particular issue. Jeff Hyman is a senior staff attorney for the Conservation Law Center. They're based in Bloomington near the IU campus, and they, on a regular basis, help provide legal counsel to organizations like conservation groups like Save the Dunes. And Jeff is with us to talk about this current measure that is working through the General Assembly and the concerns we have up here in Northwest Indiana about having the proper access to Lake Michigan. Jeff, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's good to be with you.
Well, first, if you will talk a little bit about the Conservation Law Center and how you folks there at the center got involved with the case up here in Northwest Indiana.
Well, the Conservation Law Center is actually, although we are affiliated with IU Moore School of Law in Bloomington, we are an independent nonprofit law firm that specializes in representing environmental groups in conservation matters. But we do teach a clinic here for law students, and so the Moore School of Law provides our offices and computers and so forth, and we're integrated into the law school as either adjunct faculty or faculty, but we do retain our independence in the cases we take and the matters that we decide.
When you got involved and was asked by... When you were asked by the Save the Dunes organization to help in this particular case, you obviously had to do some homework. And what did you find that interested you folks at the Conservation Law Center about this project that is now a bill that is in the Indiana House of Representatives that deals with the lakefront access here in Northwest Indiana?
Well, we've been in this subject matter since 2013. That's when the Gunderson case got started, and we were asked by two organizations, Save the Dunes, of course, but also Alliance for the Great Lakes. They're based in Chicago. Both of those groups asked us to represent them in the litigation that was just getting started over who owns the beach, which involves the public trust doctrine and equal footing doctrine and a lot of legal doctrines that people haven't really heard of, but we knew that they were very important from the conservation perspective. So we wanted to be involved in those cases to be able to shape the law as it was developing in Indiana. And so we went through all the litigation. It actually went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which denied cert in that case. Mm-hmm. But we've been in that case since 2013. And now that the Gunderson decision occurred in 2018, and then we resolved the petition for certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court, that was denied. And now there are continual attempts to undermine the holding of Gunderson because it was favorable for my clients and the state, but it was not favorable for the beachfront landowners that brought the suit in the beginning. So there's a continual attempt to shape and undermine that decision, and one of these attempts is legislation. And so last year there was very similar legislation that never made it out of committee, and this year they're trying again with this bill we're going to talk about, 1031, House Bill 1031. Yeah.
This is a measure, by the way, that was sponsored by State Representative Doug Miller from Elkhart. He has apparently an interest in this matter. Tell us first a little bit about the bill that Representative Gunderson has put out there, and perhaps a little bit about why he seems to be most interested.
There are ideological positions at stake in this litigation. This is the Gunderson litigation. And this bill, which comes out of that and attempts to undermine it and overturn it. It's all part of actually a national movement to privatize public lands. And the Gunderson Court ruled that the lakeshore below the natural ordinary high water mark is public trust land. And that irks some people ideologically because some people believe that land should be in private hands as much as possible. So it's part of a nationwide ideological battle. I would call it a battle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's played out all over the country. And this is the manifestation of that national debate for Indiana. It's being played out on the lakeshore. Now, Miller's bill, so I can't speak to why Representative Miller was keen on introducing this. Probably he was asked to do something by the beachfront landowners. They spoke in favor of the bill at the hearing the other day at the State House. Any statements I might make about his motivation or the motivation of the people behind this beyond what I've said would be sheer speculation. Mm-hmm. So, but I can tell you what the bill is attempting to do. The bill attempts to basically relinquish state ownership of the lakeshore, especially in Section 10 of the bill. It explicitly says that the state will relinquish its ownership of the shore of Lake Michigan. But it goes beyond, so that would give away some of the most valuable property that exists in Indiana, which is the lakeshore, for no reason. And I can't see any reason for giving that shore away. But it goes beyond trying to give away ownership, state ownership of the shore. It actually tries to extinguish the public's rights to use the lakeshore, and that was a key holding of the Gunderson decision. Gunderson Court, the Indiana Supreme Court, explicitly said that below the natural ordinary high water mark on the shore of Lake Michigan, the public has an inalienable right to use that shore at minimum for walking, fishing, commerce, and navigation, and that the legislature could, if it wanted, expand those uses to other recreational uses. So just to recap what I've just said, not only is the bill trying to give away the state's ownership of the shore, it's trying to give away the public's rights to use the shore.
I know that Mr. Miller, in some comments that he made to Dan Carden, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about this House Bill 1031, was that he says that there are already provisions of properties that are available, public properties available, that give citizens the right to the access to the lakefront. And this, I guess he says that there's already those access points right there now, and that it doesn't have to be more. That is, in this case, this private property.
Well, there are two points to be made there.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the lakeshore is not private property. So it's not a matter of we need to find a balance between private property on the shore and public beaches on the shore. The fact is that, as the Gunderson Court recognized, for over 150 years, the federal courts and the state courts have said that at statehood, when states like Indiana became states, and for Indiana that was 1816, when they became states, they automatically acquired the shores of their navigable water bodies below the natural ordinary high water mark. And there's no dispute that Lake Michigan is a navigable water body. So Indiana has owned this lakeshore, all of the lakeshore, all 42 to 45 miles of it, from 1816, from the moment it became a state. There's no way that there could be private ownership except if the state gave or conveyed parcels of that state land to private owners. And that was done for industries such as U.S. Steel. So there are certain parcels along the lakeshore which early on, back in the 20th century, were given to these industries to promote industrial development on the lakeshore. But there are no landowners, there are no private beachfront landowners that own this state land. There's never been any transfer, there's never been any evidence that there's been any transfer of the state property to these private landowners. So if Representative Miller is saying that there is that these beachfront landowners actually own the shore below the ordinary high water mark, that is absolutely false as a matter of law, and we have an Indiana Supreme Court decision that says so. A second point there about what you said, not only is there no private ownership, but it is true that there are so-called public beaches on the lakeshore, but this is a matter of respecting the rule of law. So what Representative Miller is trying to do is not respect private property. He's trying to give away valuable state property to private landowners for their own private use. And that's prohibited by law, by Indiana law, as affirmed by the Gunderson decision. So and let me just say, we have problems on the lakeshore. There's no doubt about that. We have erosion problems. We have beaches that are being eroded away without being accreted because of jetties and so forth, stopping the natural movement of sand. We have homes that at high water are being undermined by strong storms and wave action that these homeowners naturally want to protect their homes. And we have conflicts with the beachfront landowners and the backlot landowners of these towns along the lakeshore. This is, you know, human nature. People who buy on the beachfront don't want to see a lot of activity of the public in front of their house. So there are problems that should be solved, that need to be solved. But giving away our public trust lakeshore to private ownership is not the way to solve those problems. Those problems need to be solved in lawful ways. What Representative Miller is attempting to do is to basically have an easy fix for those serious problems by just giving it away, but it's unlawful to do that.
I understand that in the comments that Representative Miller made to Dan Cardin of the Times about this measure, that he says that he would just try to get both sides together to talk about it and come up with some kind of solution. And I guess even the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Torr of Carmel, felt the same way, too, when this all came up. And I know there's more discussion that's expected later this month as well, too, from the committee and perhaps even going to some kind of vote in the House sometime during the legislative session. But I get the impression from the comments made that this is obviously not going to be an issue that is going to be resolved during this particular legislative session.
Well, you're right. I mean, the problems that I just laid out for you, which I think are the three main problems, mm-hmm. Beach erosion, houses being washed over by strong storms at high water because they were essentially built too close to the shore to begin with in the olden days before there were buffers, and this, you know, kind of dispute between backlot owners and beachfront landowners. These three issues are not going to be solved this year. They've been going on for decades, but, you know, governments and private organizations and citizens need to really get together and solve these problems, but it's going to take compromise. But what I'm saying is that giving away the shore in a way that's contrary to the rule of law that we have in Indiana is not the way to solve those problems. And so I agree with anyone who says that we have these problems and that they need to be solved. I agree with that 100%. What I am disagreeing with is that this bill does not solve or even attempt to solve those problems. This bill basically just gives away state land and public land and public rights to use the shoreland into private ownership, and that is unlawful under the current law in Indiana.
Well, it looks like this is a matter that is likely not to be resolved this session, even if the bill does come up for some type of review or vote or whatever later in the General Assembly session. And as you say, it's not going to be an issue that's going to be quickly resolved to begin with. But we certainly appreciate you bringing up the ideas and your argument about this whole issue and your support through the Conservation Law Center for organizations like Save the Dunes about the concern about lakefront properties access by anybody, as it should be. And we thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the issue today. I hope that we'll have a chance to check back with you later in the legislative session and see how you feel about how this whole matter's progressing.
Sure, I'd be happy to, and I appreciate your time.
Well, you're welcome. Jeff Hyman is a senior staff attorney with the Conservation Law Center based with the Indiana University School of Law in Bloomington. They provide legal counsel for organizations like Save the Dunes, and they are concerned about the measure that is now in the General Assembly, sponsored by State Representative Doug Miller of Elkhart, about the access to Lake Michigan. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today. We hope you'll join us tomorrow for Reporters Roundtable Thursday.